Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Between Two Pods. I'm really, really excited for this one. I've been looking forward to it. I've had it in my calendar for a while, and I finally got Antonio from Cultworthy Studios now.
Yeah, studios, right?
Yeah, right. I was about to say Cultworthy, but it's studios now because we're up to four podcasts.
Four podcasts, yeah.
So before we get started, could you tell everybody about, I guess, each show if you'd like to, or just about you in general and where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, for sure. Well, first of all, I'll just talk about why it's Cultworthy Studios now. It all has to do with the fact that I'm too goddamn lazy to create a social account for each and every podcast. So I just took my old Cultworthy Cinema podcast handle on all my social medias, turned it into the Cultworthy Studios, and used it as like a blanket for all my other shows so I don't have to like share on four different accounts. So it has nothing to do with ambition. It has everything to do with like, I am so goddamn terrible at social media. We're just putting it under one umbrella. So yeah.
Well, it's convenience too, right? Everybody can find everything right there. That's the other. It's like, I don't know if you know the YouTuber Binging with Babish.
Uh-huh.
It's now like the Babish Culinary Universe is like right. The name of it. So it gets all the shows, but under the one label. I think it's the same, right?
Well, it's kind of, and the other one too that I kind of took a page out of their book was, you know, Your Mom's House, the Tom Segura podcast.
Ooh, yes.
Now that they have an actual studio and they have all these different shows under them, they call themselves YMH Studios. So I'm like, yeah, that works. Studios, the Cultworthy Studios.
Very cool.
I didn't upgrade to a giant warehouse facility. It's the same little corner office of the house.
That's fine. You know, that's where it's made, though. It keeps it in that nice little indie space, you know?
Yeah. All indie over here. So indie that I refuse any kind of financial compensation whatsoever. Turn my nose up at it. But so, yeah, the Cultworthy Studios now consists of four shows. The main show being the one that you've been on, and I've guested on shows that you've been on under that umbrella, and that's the Cultworthy Cinema Podcast. My movie podcast dedicated to obscure cinema, hard to find films, and cult classics. After that, I spawned a podcast called The Cultworthy Classic, which was pretty much the same thing, but for films made before 1970. So I could pay more respect to like classic films, black and white films, films from the 40s. Then I did a podcast, which I'm still doing, with a friend of mine who needed just an outlet to talk about all the crazy shit going on in her life. Beautiful, single mom. So we called that one the MILF and Me. And that's like our relationship, dating in your 40s sucks podcast. And that one's a lot of fun. But the newest one, man, that started just, I'm not going to say last week because this is far in advance, but January 2nd was the first episode of my new podcast called Back to the Balcony, where Justin Henson of The Movie Wire and I got together and created a show that analyzes the critiques of Siskel and Ebert. So each week we pick a movie, talk about, you know, our critical view of the movie, and then the last half hour we dissect the critiques of Siskel and Ebert and where they got things right, where they got things wrong. Most of the time, I'm the more cynical one, because I'm not a critic. I am not a reviewer. I'm an appreciator. Right. Justin is the critic. He is a critic on paper, and he has a critic podcast. So it's an interesting thing where like he really looks at things from a critical eye, and I'm the one like, but yeah, Chopping Mall fucking rules, man. I don't care if people think it sucks. Like, that's kind of where we come from, and it's a lot of fun.
It's a great balance kind of between the two of you. I'm glad y'all actually have something together to, you know, merge those. I don't want to say like opposing opinions, but it is two good perspectives, if that makes sense.
Which 100%, because I think we even talked about this on one of the episodes that we shared together, was it seems that there are people who only want to talk shit about movies. There's so many just talking shit podcasts, and that's fine, to each their own. You like what you like. But for me, it's all about, well, there are so many things that people consider trash or people consider a B-grade movie, but they haven't taken the time to analyze how influential that trash might be to future and current filmmakers. Like, oh, you know, this whole sequence of this movie that was only on, let's say, a 16 millimeter grindhouse theater. Well, now Tarantino's using it, and now De Palma's using it, and now Paul Thomas Anderson's using it. So that's my whole point of it. It's more of like a historian and appreciator, and right. an Indiana Jones type character of like, I'm gonna find the hidden treasure and show you, you know, where all your cool shit these days comes from and who's ripping it off. That's where I come from.
Right. It's like, who, what inspired this originally? You know, like, where did the idea for like a certain kind of shot comes from, or maybe a writing style?
Right. And people would be surprised how much of current media, TV, movies, hell, even like web series and podcasts really owe a lot to forgotten films and TV shows and actors. Like, it really is kind of shameful how much things are recycled these days. And our friends at Talking Smack talk about this all the time when it comes to how many times are they going to reboot and remake and recycle stuff that's even still current, you know? Stuff from 10, 20 years ago, let alone 50 years ago.
Right. And it seems like, you know, some things they, I don't know if you're familiar with like the Tomb Raider franchise. It seems like maybe every 5 years or so it gets rebooted.
Right.
And, like, you get the origin story again. It's like, well, have the treads worn off the first pair of boots we put on? Because we haven't gone any further. We're just looking at the origin story again.
Right. It's like, do we really need another Batman origin story? We all know the dude's parents died.
Yeah.
Like, same with Spider-Man.
I would like to see one of those, but it's like in fast forward. And then, you know, it just gets to whatever villain that they're deciding to fight in this one.
Right.
Don't cover it. We all know it. You know, you can go over the cliff notes of it. Let's move on.
Well, I mean, and that's one of the reasons why I was actually a bigger fan of Joaquin Phoenix's Joker than a lot of my contemporaries were. Not that I liked the movie, but I liked the idea that they were ambitious enough to not necessarily change the origin story, because the origin story already is kind of shaky. Like, there's different ideas of how that happens. But being able to take a premise and create a character that exists in that DC universe, but not necessarily the DC universe that everyone's accustomed to, you know? I like that. I would like to see more things do that kind of, let's break away from the traditional storytelling and be a little bit more ambitious. Because if we're going to remake shit, let's put our own spin on it, you know?
Absolutely. I'd like to point out, I haven't even gotten to a question yet, and here we are already having a great conversation. It's going to be an excellent episode. Now, I have to tell you, I have some of my own questions, but I reached out to a couple of mutual friends of ours.
Uh-huh.
Who have things they want to ask you.
Interesting.
So, to go off that list, it's just three of them, but Dan from Everett Casting Views, your new co-host, Justin, he has a couple questions for you.
Oh, great.
And our friends at Talking Smack, plus Maya. And so, as you being the guest, where would you like to start? Do you want to start with mine? Do you want to pick one of those three and say which one's your favorite?
let's get these kiddos out of the way, because I know they're listening to the episode, so I'm not gonna like have them sit there with bated breath. Let's just go ahead and get their questions out so they can go on and do whatever else they're doing.
All right, well, so in my notes I'm just gonna do them in the alphabetical order, because that's how I put it. So we'll start with Dan from Casting Views.
Yeah.
So are there any cult worthy movies or films, as Dan writes, that you would like to see remade? So that would be like remaking them with modern tech and styles to give it, you know, like an extra oomph to it, like, you know, where modern cameras can today.
Okay, I like this question. That's a really good question. That's a Dan question. I can't be too hypocritical, because I've said way too many times on all of my shows, essentially, that I'm not a huge fan of remakes. But I do have some caveats. For one, I don't think a film should be remade in its own language unless it's over 50 years old. So if it's an American film, unless it's over 50 years old, don't touch it. Leave it alone. That's number one. I'm cool with foreign remakes, right? Like, if you're going to make a foreign remake so you can get more recognition to the original, I'm cool with it. Even if it sucks, it still brings recognition to the original. So, for example, The Departed. Pretty decent remake of a Chinese film, which I prefer, called Infernal Affairs. However, Spike Lee's Old Boy remake can go fuck itself. Like, But it's fine because it gave people who didn't know about the original Old Boy a cue to go check out the original. So right. I'm cool with those kind of things. So, yeah, I wouldn't remake a film that's any kind of newer contemporary film just because I didn't like the thing that someone did. I always thought, though, it would be cool if someone could go back and do a remake of North by Northwest, the Alfred Hitchcock.
Okay.
But really kind of make it modern in the sense of point out how ridiculous that premise actually is, you know, because that guy would literally be dead. Give it a little bit more danger in that aspect. I like the whole idea of like normal guy gets caught up in a situation with spies and blah, blah, blah. It'd be more of a tech thing these days, but I always thought that was a story that could use a nice coat of paint. Or I have this thing that I call retro remakes.
Okay.
So let's say you take a movie like North by Northwest, which was made in the 50s, but instead of doing it in the 50s, place it like in the 1920s, right? Place it in the past. Where we really talked about this is I was a guest on Silver Screeners podcast, and we were talking about the remake of The Taking of Pelham 123. So the original was 1970s, Walter Matthau. The remake was in the early 2000s, mid-2000s with John Travolta. And they said, well, what would make this movie better? I said, take it back. Like, go back to like the 1920s or 30s and have it be like in the old school New York subway or a streetcar in San Francisco. So retro remake, I'm kind of warming up to a little bit more as I think about movies like that. So that'd be my answer.
Okay, very cool. Next question for you is, do you feel that the newer generations are less interested in older films? Now, I kind of want to hop in on here a little bit, because a lot of my favorites are like movies from like the 80s or it's I guess a cult-worthy classic for you. You ever watched Johnny Got His Gun?
Yeah, that's a fantastic movie.
It's a tremendous movie. And I don't know, I think certain things cue you into watching it. I don't know what, you know, for me, like I'm a drummer by trade and I love playing music. And, you know, when I found out what the song "One" by Metallica was, I ended up staying up late and watching it and loved the film. It was excellent. And, you know, which is what the song's based off of. I think things like that maybe, you know, kind of get the younger people like myself into it. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this.
Well, for sure. And I think that old movies are essentially going to be the next vinyl craze, right? You know?
Okay. So like VHSs maybe?
Well, we're seeing it right now with boutique labels. Like boutique label Blu-rays are taking old movies from like the 60s, 70s, 80s, midnight movies on USA, like USA Up All Night and Night Flight and shit like that. And they're getting these beautiful Blu-ray 4K releases on Vinegar Syndrome and Arrow and all these different boutique labels. That's the future. You know, so as they say that physical media is going away, I think mass market physical media is going away, like Best Buy and shit like that.
Right.
It's going to be boutique label now.
I was about to say, because Best Buy just pulled, you know, all of its DVDs, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's this year that's supposed to happen.
Yeah, it was literally this week.
No, was it?
Yeah, it was literally this week. Second week of January 2024 is the nail in the coffin for physical media at Best Buy.
Right. And I mean, and Dan and I are both vinyl collectors. I have like a...
Me too, man.
Yeah. Oh, I love them.
I got 3,000 downstairs that I've been collecting since I was 16. So that's my... And I'm not the only one with this opinion. I've been seeing lots of articles lately because of the Best Buy thing.
Right.
There's a difference between mass market and boutique. And it's that way with every form of physical media, whether it's a cassette or vinyl, 8-track, they are going to print off thousands and thousands and thousands of copies of Smells Like Teen Spirit, right?
Right.
But the one that people want will be the original pressing. Right. Or the one that was remastered and has signatures or some kind of liner note or commentary, something that makes it more than just the one that everyone could get. Films and TV shows that are on these boutique labels are the same thing. You know, so it's not just that one you could buy in the $5 bin at Walmart for the last 20 years. It's going to be the one that, oh, it's got a new commentary. And here's a cool thing, man. These labels now are reaching out to podcasters to do audio commentaries or recognition pieces on these films. So that is an outlet for us. It'd be like if some video game label, let's say Bethesda or someone, listened to your podcast and liked it and said, hey, Slade, do you want to come and do like a commentary track on this making of video? Like, that's happening.
Oh, yeah. I'd be so excited about that.
That's where I think it's going. The younger generations are catching on because I think the industries really kind of dropped the ball when they thought that, yes, the future is digital, but that's the future of mass market consumption.
Right.
Humans are always going to want something tangible, especially younger generations who, like, they didn't get cool toys like we did. They didn't get all the cool shit that we got to play with or stuff that would hurt us when we were kids. Like, you know, some toy that came with a rocket launcher that could shoot your eye out. Like, we grew up with that. They didn't. So it's
lawn darts, you know.
Yeah, lawn darts, 100%. That's the kind of shit that they're gonna be like, oh, I want that for myself.
Right. So, last question from Dan here is, do you feel that there are less chances of cult-worthy films in the future due to risk versus reward?
Not at all, because studios like A24 and Neon and Pathé, they are all making films that they make them for a profit, but they're avant-garde enough to know that they're not going to reach every audience. And I think that last year was a real high watermark for that, because Everything Everywhere All at Once won Best Picture. It swept the Oscars.
Oh, yeah.
A film like that 20 years ago would not even be considered for the Oscars. So, yes, it made a lot of money, but it was not made with the intention of being a blockbuster. That came organically. And that doesn't mean that if it didn't make a lot of money, it wouldn't be a cult film in the future. It absolutely would be.
Right.
So, yeah, I think, and it's a hot debate, man, and I have this debate all the time. Can you intentionally make a cult movie? I think yes, but the ones that are really recognizable are the ones that happen organically.
Gotcha. Do you think streaming, this isn't even on my questions, it's just something I thought of while you're talking about that. Do you think streaming lends itself to helping that cult-worthy status?
Yes,
like the fact 100%. That a lot of things, they're now available digitally, and, you know, if you're sitting there in your house and I'm over here, you know, you could use things like Discord or maybe here in Zencastr, I don't know, and you could stream the movie together. We could sit down here and watch it.
Yeah.
That's how
Tubi, man.
Yeah,
Tubi is my hero, because Tubi doesn't give a shit about who's watching what. It will literally put anything on there. The let's say the pretentious film watchers will be like, oh, Tubi, that trash. I have Mubi and the Criterion Channel. It's like, yeah, okay, I love those movies too, but Tubi's fucking free, and they're playing movies that I haven't been able to watch in decades because they literally buried these VHS tapes in bargain bins or in fucking landfills. And
right.
Now we get to watch them again. Like, I don't think they understand the value in that these movies were gone and we're seeing them again and people are discovering again. That's why there are so many obscure movie and cult film podcasts now, because anyone can talk about Die Hard. Anyone can talk about Home Alone, and they did in December. But now we're talking about Christmas Evil and Silent Night, Deadly Night, like movies that people try to bury, and now we can watch them anytime, anywhere. Yeah, 100% streaming is helping that.
Is Die Hard a Christmas movie? Oh, I want to know this.
So you obviously didn't listen to my episode on it.
No. I was catching up on some stuff I usually did right beforehand, but
it was a hot debate. A lot of people had that, is Die Hard a Christmas movie? I'm on team, yes, it is. But there are a lot of people who say, team, no, it's not. I say, it's up to you. Like, artist objective.
I don't think that Christmas is the important part of it. I think that's one of the things that makes a Christmas movie, if that makes sense. So you could have set that movie at any other time, and it would have done fine.
Yes, it would have done fine, but since it uses Christmas as one of its main plot drivers, with the ho, 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 with the Christmas music, he's at a Christmas party, they're doing it
right.
On Christmas Eve because of the police presence. Like, it's part of the plan to do it at Christmas, therefore I think that is enough of a driver to make it a Christmas movie. No one gives a fuck if it's Halloween, you know?
Right, exactly. I think that's a fair argument, to be honest. So we're going to move on to Justin's questions for you. And Justin wants to know, most important filmmaker of our time?
Okay, I'm gonna say living then, if he's saying our time, because you, I think you still have to be making movies to be considered right. in that. I'm definitely gonna say Scorsese.
Okay.
For the main and simple reason is because he has created too many subgenres. He's still making movies. He's still winning Oscars. He is still attracting audiences of all ages. You know, you can get your 90-year-old grandpa excited to see a Scorsese film, and you can get your teenage cousin excited to see a Scorsese film. So when it comes to like career longevity, I'm definitely going to say Scorsese. I bet Justin probably would say Spielberg. Where I disagree with that is that Spielberg definitely has a motive, and that motive is finance. He's not out there to make movies that are going to change the world and create subgenres. He's a businessman. He's looking for box office. And the easiest way to get box office is to tug on people's heartstrings, and that's his magic wand, right? That's where he is,
right.
Like the ultimate puppet master of the industry.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you say Spielberg, for me, my first thought's like Band of Brothers, not even like a movie. I'm thinking like a TV show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also a good example, like you said, of tugging on the heartstrings. That show does a tremendous job of that. Even though it's only 10 episodes, you get really attached to those guys.
Yeah. And it's formulated to be that way, and there's nothing wrong right. with that. Like, that's why people like pop songs that have simple chord structures, because it attracts them to it, like moths to a flame, right? It's
right.
it's science, essentially.
Right. What is your go-to movie when you can't decide what to watch?
This is from Justin?
Yes.
He should fucking know this. My go-to movie is Hot Tub Time Machine.
Really?
Yeah, I've said this on several shows where it is literally my, if I'm drunk, if I'm sober, if it's on streaming and I see that little stupid icon, I'm watching it. It just makes me feel good. Is it right. a good movie? Fuck no, but it makes me happy. And that's why it's I'm watching Hot Tub Time Machine.
Your guilty pleasure movie, is it also Hot Tub Time Machine? Is it the same answer?
No, my guilty pleasure movie, and he probably is pretty close on this too, and I've said it on several shows, my guilty pleasure movie is Super Mario Brothers the movie from 1990.
Really? The 1990?
100%. Saw it in the theater by myself like 3 times, and I'm not embarrassed to say that I pre-ordered the Australian umbrella label 4K with all of the bonus features and the posters and all that shit. It was like $150. I pre-ordered it like 8 months ago, and it's supposed to be arriving this month, and I'm so fucking excited for it.
That's really awesome. If you have to show one movie to somebody from the past to show an example of technology, culture, and film appreciation, what movie would it be?
Blade Runner.
Blade Runner.
Yep. Yeah. I'm going to tell you why. Blade Runner. So, it is pioneering special effects, practical special effects, especially.
Right.
That not only are avoiding, let's say, science fiction space battles and Star Wars and Star Trek shit, it's showing that kind of technology, but on a destroyed Earth, which we're heading for. But it also is just a champion of film noir aesthetic, from the music, which sounds like a 1940s film noir, to the detective story, to the camera angles, the narration. And then there's action elements and there's romance elements. It is one of the few films that actually blends several of my favorite film genres together and does it successfully. So that's why I say it's a great film for future film appreciators to study, because it's going to take them in many different paths. It'll take them into sci-fi. It'll take them into French New Wave like Alphaville. It'll take them into film noir. And then it'll right. take them down the path of Ridley Scott, who is, I mean, I think he struggles in the last 20 years, but he was the master of genre. He can make a horror film. He can make a sci-fi film. He can make a comedy. He can make an action film. He can make Thelma and Louise. Like, he is one of the last of the old guards of directors that could literally make anything. And right. make it a good film.
All right. And I have one more question from Justin for you.
Yeah.
It is, what makes Justin such an amazing, phenomenal, and incredible co-host?
that he's not me. If it was two of me's trying to do Back to the Balcony, that shit wouldn't work. He and I are so, we're similar in a lot of our tastes in movies, but we're so different in how we analyze, critique, and appreciate them. And that's what makes him a great co-host, is that it's not two sides of the same coin having a discussion. Like I said, my biggest problem with the shit-talking movie podcasts is that it's all the dudes who talk the same and act the same and they have the same right. remarks. And
you get podcast energy guy.
Right.
Yeah.
And good for them if they're doing well. I want everyone to do well. But I like to hear discourse. Discourse is my favorite thing. It's like why I like to get in arguments sometimes on Twitter. It's just like, I'm not trying to tell you you're wrong. I'm trying to tell you why I'm right.
It's like one of my co-hosts, Tim, they've ended it now. They did 2 years of this where once a week they would watch a movie and it would be the same movie every week for a year. The first movie they did was The Fanatic.
Oh, with Travolta.
Yeah. Which that was shot like an hour from where I live, by the way, which is wild to think about. I remember seeing like the, you know, people be like, oh, I saw John Travolta downtown. And then when the movie came out, heard nothing. And then I saw how bad it did in the box office.
Yeah. With his little Lloyd Christmas haircut.
Yeah. It only made like $3,000. Like, wow. I mean, that's, yeah, it's just awful. And then they did a second year of it where they watched Catwoman, the Halle Berry one.
Oh.
Once a week for a year. And that's what broke it. That's what ended the project after that.
That's like some kind of Clockwork Orange shit, man. It's crazy. Yeah.
So I have three questions from Talking Smack. One of them they didn't actually send to me. I recorded them with them last night.
Uh-huh.
And Josh just, I told him that we were doing this and he made a joke and it made me laugh enough that I wrote it down as a question from them. First one though, Josh would like to know, where do you hide your time machine?
is he trying to say that I'm doing too much and the time allowed doesn't seem physically possible?
Yes, I think that's what that's getting
at. I've told Josh this. It's not time. It's efficiency.
Right.
You know, just thinking steps ahead and all that stuff like that. Essentially, I've created a system for myself where I'm literally editing my shows while I'm doing other things. So like today, I folded the laundry, washed the dishes, changed the baby's room around, blah, blah, blah. And that whole time, I got my laptop on a table playing the episode and I can just stop and snip and continue playing while I'm doing it. So I don't lock myself in my office to do shit. I can't do that. I'm too busy. So I've created systems to allow me to do stuff while I'm multitasking.
Yeah. No, I feel that. That's why, like, you know, when I'm playing games, this is a 3-monitor setup that I have. So a lot of times I may have, like, you know, the edit running, and if I'm editing like a mainline game club, we actually censor that. So in that case, like, I'm listening. Oh, pause it. Let me go throw in a bleep and
take that fuck word out. Yeah.
But in this case, we can say whatever we want to.
That was, nice.
I hate censorship with a passion. I just don't think it should be a thing. You know?
I stopped censoring my show. I'm not crazy with the language, but it was back, I want to say, around November. I was like, why am I censoring it? Like, we're not super vulgar. We just say fuck every now and then or shit.
Right.
So it just made it a lot more... easy to edit, but get your point across. Sometimes, like, I need a good god damn it in there, right?
Exactly.
Like, you just need it to get your point across. And so, yeah, I stopped editing my show.
There you go. Alex from Talking Smack. Again, this goes back to Josh's question as well. How do you have the time for so many podcasts? Because realistically, like, you know, you and I can sit here and talk about, like, the time to edit and everything, but let's say, you know, you're also watching a 90-minute movie as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And across maybe 3 different movie platforms, you know, that time adds up, plus recording and then editing later.
It sounds crazy, and I don't want to sound like I'm showing off, but post-production of the podcast literally is the least amount of my time.
Yeah.
It really is. So, like, with my video podcast now... I am switching camera angles live. I'm not doing video editing.
Okay, so you're doing that on the fly.
That's on the fly. It's while I'm doing it. So if we were talking right now, mm-hmm. I'd be switching from your camera to my camera with my little up and down key, so I don't have to go and switch camera angles later. And also, there's an AI program in my editor that, if I wanted to, I could just have it switch angles the second someone starts talking. So
that makes it way easier.
Yeah, so the post-production takes the least amount of my time. For example, back to the blockbuster, we have 10 episodes in the bank. So even if one of us gets sick for a week, it's not like we're scrambling. My whole point is to never be scrambling. That's how I do have time to watch. And this is also why I'm not a contemporary critic. I don't have to wait for shit to come out in the theater or hit the shelves or be the newest game on Steam or something to review it. All my stuff is fucking 50 years old and I have access to it whenever I want. So there's a little bit of method to that madness too.
Exactly. So this is what they, Josh inadvertently said last night that made me laugh and I just had to throw it in. When is the DILF and me podcast going to start?
Whenever he's ready to come and start it, man. I've never seen a sexier dad than Josh Scar in his cute little glasses.
Well, once again, I'd like to thank Justin Henson of the Movie Wire, Dan of Casting Views, and Talking Smack for the questions. Now, are you ready for mine?
Yeah, man, this is fun. I'm having a blast.
I find the show's a lot of fun because everybody, you know, inherently everybody likes to talk about themselves. You know, at the end of the day, I think people do like to, and, you know, the fact that you're getting asked questions and you just get to...
Yeah, I only like to talk about myself when people ask me. Seriously.
Yeah. I think that's what makes this so much fun, to be honest. And yeah. Everybody gets their little time in the spotlight. It's great.
Yeah.
So let's do this, because I also asked Justin this when I had him on. You and I are going to go watch a movie together.
Okay.
And we got to set this up, right? Because, you know, I'm not a big film guy. Because it is a question later about the immersion of film versus, like, you know, I prefer video games, but we'll get that one when we get to that one. So let's start this. What's the ideal setup for watching a movie?
You know, I think it really depends on the person. I am such... I don't have OCD and I don't have ADD. I literally can focus on 10 things at once and understand what's going on. So my preferred method of seeing a movie is probably in my office. I got a monitor just to the right of me where I watch most of my movies while I'm editing or making poster art and shit like that, because I can do both at the same time. I like seeing films in the theater, but it's not necessarily a need. That's more of like, that's indulgence for me. I've kind of grown accustomed to not trying to watch movies I want to pay attention to for the first time if I'm with my partner or my kids, because I don't want to miss anything, right? And she might be on her phone and I'll be like, okay, well, did you catch that part? And the kid might be running and stuff like that. I'll take any opportunity to watch a movie, but if it's for the show, 9 times out of 10, it's here in my office watching this monitor while I'm doing something else. And I have said this a few times on the show, I'll watch a film 2 or 3 times before I talk about it on the show, especially if it's got commentary. Like, I'll watch it once, then once with commentary, and then all the special features and things like that. So yeah, I think it really depends. If it's for entertainment, I'd say on a nice big screen by myself, a snack, a beer. If it's for the podcast, I like it to be more in the work mode so I can like feel like I have to be doing it.
Right. So, well, you threw me into the next part of this. Snacks, what are we having? You know, you can't just sit down and watch a movie with nothing. What is the go-to snacks?
I like pretzels, like crunchy pretzels. I like nachos, I think is my favorite. Like, I'll make a big plate of nachos. I'm not a huge popcorn guy. Like, it's fine. I like it, but it's not like a necessary thing. But 100%, I've got to have either beers or a nice glass of wine. Like, that's more important. I don't even need snacks at that point where I can just do that.
Right. A little something to sip on with you while you're watching. I kind of feel you. You know, it's the first time pretzels. I always feel like pretzels don't get enough love.
They don't get enough love.
They don't.
Yeah. 100%, I like the Rolls Golds are my favorites.
Okay. I like the, the little pretzel sticks, like the really thin ones.
Yeah.
Like stick ones. Those are my favorite. And if you put a bag of those next to me, that bag will be gone in a matter of minutes, because I can't be trusted with those things.
And they're kind of guilt-free, right? Like, they're not covered in butter. They don't have all that, like, powdery shit on them. It's a clean eat. You don't have to wipe your fingers after each bite. Yeah, 100%.
Right. Exactly. And the last part of this, you know, so we've got it nailed down. We're going to have some pretzels. We're going to have some cold drinks with us. What are we watching?
So are we watching a film together to podcast it, or am I showing you a film for the first time that you haven't seen?
If either way, the answer would, I still probably wouldn't have seen the movie if we're honest, but
okay.
Yeah. But this is just you and I going to watch a movie together.
All right. So I like to watch action films or very grotesque and somewhat violent comedies when I'm with a friend.
Okay.
Because I need someone to laugh with. I need someone to be like, oh shit, to John Wick's especially. I think John Wick's like the perfect buddy movies, because you can both be like, did you see that fucking guy get his head chopped off? Like that kind of shit. I love that kind of stuff. So action movies or movies like Jackass and stuff like that, I think are the best movies to watch with a friend. Otherwise, I'm cool with the solo shit.
Gotcha. So let's talk about like immersion, right? So for me, I always have a hard time, like, you know, when I'm watching actual people on screen do things, like getting immersed and really feeling that story.
Okay.
Because I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's just that I'm looking at people's faces and it lacks, or sometimes I'm too busy thinking about the production back end of it, right? Like the movie 1917. Mm-hmm. You know, and that there's what, three cuts in the whole movie.
Yeah,
and I'm too busy looking around, you know, trying to spot like, all right, where'd they cut, you know, and thinking about that.
So
for you, how do you keep yourself, you know, not thinking about that when you're watching a film?
Dude, it's like training a muscle. It really is, because what you explained, especially with that film and Children of Men was the other one too, when it came out. There was a part of me that wanted to dissect everything upon the first viewing. And what you're doing is you're robbing yourself of the filmmaker's intent to entertain you and to impress you. When you go into something with too much of an analytical mind the first time, you're literally just setting yourself up for a bad time. Because it's like going to a magic show and spending the whole time trying to figure out how the magician did it, right? It's not fun. So you train your brain, at least I did, to walk into a film kind of just blind, let the film do what it was meant to do. And then if that film resonated with you, go back and watch it again and then try and figure out the tricks. That's what I do. And that's one of the main things that Justin and I talk about with Siskel and Ebert is some of their harshest reviews about films that have stood the test of time. You have to remember that they only watched those movies once and then wrote a 500 to 1,000 word piece on it and then moved on to the next. So you're literally taking a film at face value instead of allowing yourself to be absorbed in the film with a second or even a third watch if needs be.
Right.
For example, I didn't like Hot Tub Time Machine the first time I watched it because I was not doing what the film was meant to do to me, right? Like I was watching it as like, this script is fucking stupid. And then you watch it like, oh, wait, this script is supposed to be fucking stupid. And then you let that wave of happiness over you. That's where I kind of come from with that.
All right. Now, this is something interesting. You kind of had a bit about this, but I want to talk to you about hauntings.
Ooh.
Right? So is it just you that's experienced this? I don't know if, you know, a lot of our listeners also listen to Casting Views, and they've probably heard some of the things you know supernatural things you've experienced. Is it just you? Is it other people in your family? Or is there like a, how do I want to word this, like a young age where you notice things like this happening?
Like, as if, did I not need my parents to tell me about hauntings they experienced for me to believe about hauntings, essentially, is what you're saying?
Kinda, yeah. Did you experience them on your own first? Is it just something in the family that runs? Or,
well, it was just you? If people had listened to that episode, it was the house and my grandmother's houses that were all haunted. So the experiences did travel from my mom and my dad, who spent a lot of time with my grandmother before I was born, and then after I was born, in different houses that were haunted, but they never told me about it. I experienced it for myself, and it wasn't until I said something about it that they're like, oh, well, the last house was haunted too, and my mom grew up in a haunted house. And what it turned out after my grandmother passed away is she was actually summoning shit. Like when they dug through her closet, they found like crystal skulls and Ouija boards and all that kind of shit like that. So I've talked to people who said they've experienced hauntings and haunted houses, and I totally believe most of them because, you know, they weren't people that were looking for attention. Like, I told my story, like, oh my God, well, this happened to me when I was a kid. I think, too, it's like, I mean, we are talking about this on a podcast, but I often doubt people that go and, like, bare their soul and testimony on TV. It's like, you're just looking for attention, right?
Right.
But when someone who seems like a level-headed person I've known in my life said, oh, yeah, I saw a ghost in a cemetery, or I have a friend who swears they saw ghosts at, what's it called, Gettysburg. They went to the Gettysburg battle site, right, and they swear they saw something. I believe them because they're people that don't generally say shit like that.
Right. And, you know, it's like in my work, you know, I travel the state doing like soil engineering, but to see some of those like old Civil War sites, you know, there's like a different air and different atmosphere to it.
Oh, you know, well, yeah.
You can just tell that, you know, the place that you're at, there's just something, you know, there maybe.
And I think if you believe in that stuff, you have to really come to grips with what your belief of existence is. You know, so I'm not necessarily a believer of heaven, hell, afterlife. You know, I'm a pretty stone cold atheist. So how I make sense of that kind of experience to me is energy. I think since we are energy embodied, we leave energy behind, and bad energy might stay longer than good energy, and that's why we see bad things. But not to get into a conspiracy theory pit here, I'm really starting to get, I'm not going to say fascinated or interested in, but I'm getting more and more convinced about interdimensional shit. Like, we keep hearing all these weird things going on, and like that Miami Mall thing where it's like, is it aliens? Is it demons? Is it interdimensional beings? I mean, that shit does seem weird. I'm not going to post an opinion on it yet because I know nothing about it. But I do think that there might be some interdimensional shit going on as well. But right. I'm not gonna hang my hat on that.
No, but it's also wild just to say that it's just us. You know, they're like, as far as we know, it's just us. You know,
right?
But like, you don't really know what else is out there or what other technology exists.
No, absolutely not. And like, we already can prove that we're slaves to capitalism. So, who's to say that we're not slaves to something else that we're not aware of? Whether it's like an energy being or dimensional shit, like. I'm pretty much so detached from any kind of ideology that I'm pretty go with the flow on anything. I'm like, oh, that's actually kind of convincing. I'm not going to hang my hat on it, but yeah, that makes kind of sense, you know?
Right, exactly. you don't rule it out, but you don't, you know, fully believe it either.
Right.
It's just like, it's just like a mental note of it.
It works for me.
So I normally ask people how their podcast got started, but for you, I have to say, what's the origin story between all the different shows? I don't know if I really don't know where to start with you on this one.
Well, I mean,
so I guess we can start with like just the Cult Worthy itself, right? And that we just go one show at a time.
Over the last 5 years, so the Cult Worthy is 2.5 years old now.
Right.
So I'm going to say the 5 years before that, there were lots of ideas bouncing off of podcasts. The problem was, is I didn't think that I could do it on my own, and the people that I kept like pairing up with kept flaking out. I'm sure you've experienced that too. It's like, you have an idea, you have a mission, you got people that are on board, and then when it's time to sit down and hit record, no one fucking shows up. Like, that's kind of what the deal was for me.
Right.
I started doing the Cult Worthy as a blog first. Like, I was writing reviews, and I was kind of cheating because like I started my Cult Worthy website, and all I was doing was taking all of my reviews I'd written for Letterboxd and just copying and pasting them into my blog. It's like, two for the price of one, double dip. And then when I started this show, that's how it started. I triple dipped. I took my Letterboxd reviews, copied them into the blog, and then just fucking read them on the podcast. You know, it's like, we're talking about zombie movies today. The movie today is The Beyond by Lucio Fulci. And I would just read the review in that stupid voice. I think I did like 20 of those, right? And someone reached out to me and said, hey, I'd love to be a guest on your show. It's like, shit, someone wants to, I just talked to myself. So sure, let's get you on. And we talked Predator 2. That was the first movie I talked about with some guy. And he was actually a podcaster who is part of the AVP Galaxy Network, like this decades old alien versus predator fan site that's had a podcast since podcasts were formed. And I thought it went pretty well. And so I started reaching out to people like, hey, listen to this. And if you want to be on the show, let me know. And people just kept reaching out to the point where it's like, well, I don't have to do the show by myself anymore. I can literally have a weekly guest and talk about these obscure films. So it went from a review show to a discourse and conversation show. And that's how it's been for literally the last 2 years.
And see, and I have a lot of admiration for the solo people who can just talk to themselves. Prior to me podcasting, I was a Twitch streamer.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I had affiliates, so I was making money from it. But to be able to sit there and, like, you kind of have to be cross-eyed in a way, because you have to be looking at one monitor to read chat, and you need to be focusing on what you're playing at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, and so a lot of times I would just hop in Discord calls with friends while they're talking. I'd be playing, and I didn't have to say a word, or I'd just, you know, chime in on the conversation, which made that way easier. So I have a lot of admiration for people who can just, you know, talk to themselves, essentially. Without it seeming like you're rambling too much, because we all, at the end of the day, it's part of podcasting, you end up on some kind of rambling tangent.
It's true. And for conversation and like public speaking, I did that anyway. So in my, I'm in the culinary industry. I'm more on the retail side of it now, but for 15 years, I was an executive and corporate chef for a restaurant group out here in Utah. I went to culinary school, and I literally would every day teach the wait staff of all the restaurants, teach the cooking crew. I'd have a spiel. I would do cooking videos for them to learn how to do the new specials and stuff like that. So I already felt uncomfortable. I already felt comfortable in the camera and speaking. And then they had me do like the radio spots and stuff. Right. So when it came time to sit down in front of a microphone, that was the easiest part for me because I was already kind of used to it. It was coming up with content every week. That was the challenge.
Doing that solo, I mean, that's even harder when you think about it, because you don't have somebody really to bounce ideas back and forth off of. You know, thankfully with the game club, there's three of us, you know, so we can have a good conversation about, hey, what should we do, this, that, or the other.
Right. And this is where I think we can go back to Scar's question. Is like, okay, well, how do you find the time? And like, again, I don't want to sound pretentious like I'm showing off, but the efficiency part of it, I've been working with cheat codes on this shit since day one. Like I said, triple dipping the reviews that were already in existence on Letterboxd and not retyping stuff. Like that was cheat code number one. And then being proactive on how to make my post-production easier. That was cheat code number two. I know I don't have as big of an audience or as many listeners or downloads as some of the wider guys out there, but I hear them all the time complain about, I don't know how I'm going to find the time, and they leave everything for the last minute. And it's like, okay, well, I may not have the numbers that you do, but I don't have the stress that you've created for yourself. That's right. That's, if I could teach a class, that's what it would be. It's like how not to stress yourself out doing this shit. But I don't have like the numbers or sponsors to like show that it actually works in an economical sense. I'm just trying to teach you how not to stress your shit out.
We have the Coltworthy's like origin and everything. How did the MILF in me start?
That was me just reaching out to a friend who needed help and said, hey, if you need to talk about this shit, you're funny. Let's get you on the podcast. That's literally what it was. Like, let's create something for you. It was not another venue for me. I talk enough, right? it was literally me saying like, you get fucked over by these dudes every week. And then you come to my house and you just say the funniest shit about how dating in your 40s sucks. What if you had an audience for that? Right?
Oh, it's a brilliant idea. It's a brilliant show. Yeah.
That's how it started. And then the whole only reason why we started doing video is because this dude that had a crush on her said, you look good on video. Let me show you how to do like a YouTube setup. And he kind of showed us. And we just started doing it. And now all of my shit's on video because I've already got the shit. Like, why wouldn't I not do it? You know?
Right, exactly. So why not just go ahead and have it on YouTube anyway?
Right. Like, because that's one thing I was fighting. Is like, I'm not going to be on YouTube. That's too much work. Okay, well, I figured out how to make it not be a lot of work. And if anything, it's easier now because now all I have to do is make the video and I'm just literally exporting the audio from the video, and that's my podcast. I'm not fucking around in Audacity anymore. I'm not tweaking shit and blah, blah, blah. Like, I've literally made it that much easier by doing video, and I didn't think that was going to be the case.
And my last origin story, how did, obviously, you know, you and Justin are friends, but where did the idea for the critique of the critics, was that just you two trying to figure out how to make a show together, or is this just something that, you know, just came naturally for a good idea?
It's a little bit of both. Like, I gave up the Cult-Worthy Classic because it was hard to find guests because they all wanted to talk about modern shit. Not enough guests wanted to talk about the old movies. Right. So I was like, it's not doing a lot for me, so I'm going to leave it up, but I'm just going to kind of stop doing that. But I needed to focus my energy on something else. He'd been on enough of my shows. Like, he is like probably my most frequent guest on the Cult-Worthy anyway. And we always talked about critiques and reviews, and we had friendly discourse about, like, the one that really did it was we had a conversation about a film called Massacre at Central High in one of our high school episodes. I never said it was a good movie, but I said it was highly influential because you saw so much of the things they do in that movie in future movies, future horror movies and suspense movies and high school movies, like Class of 1984 borrows a lot from it. So it was that discourse of like how much he didn't like the movie and how much I did and why it was important. It almost sounded like we were having a Siskel and Ebert debate on that episode. And so I was like, well, we should just do a podcast about Siskel and Ebert. And that's what we did. And that was the inspiration for that show, essentially.
That's awesome. Antonio, I hate to tell you, we have 3 questions left.
Cool.
And one of these that I would love to know, it is one of my favorite indie, well, he is my favorite indie filmmaker. None of his movies are good, but they make for a good watch to get drunk with friends. It is the one and only Neil Breen.
Oh, God.
Have you ever had a Neil Breen movie night, would be my question.
I haven't had a movie night. I did watch several of his. Not Fatal Findings. What's it called?
Well, Fatal Findings is one of them.
Fatal Findings is the
newest one, if I'm not mistaken.
So Fatal Findings is the one that I did watch in completion. And the other two, I don't remember their names, but I've watched bits and pieces. But I'm fully aware of who the dude is.
So there's 6 movies now that he's made. There's double, and I've seen all of them except for his newest film, which is Cade the Torture Crossing. But Fateful Findings, I've seen Twisted Pair, Double Down, Pass Through, I Am Here, Now. And they make for a brilliant night to just have a good excuse to get drunk with friends.
I'd do it. I would do it in a second. I would need a reason to go. Like, I wouldn't host that party myself, but if we lived in the same city and you said I'm having a Neil Breen night, you guarantee I'd be fucking there in a second. I saw Fateful Findings in a double feature with The Room at our local brew pub. Like, one of my programmer friends who programs movies for that, he's like, oh, I'm gonna fuck up some audience members tonight, and he did a double feature. And I want to say that of that month, that was like their biggest bar take of the month for one of those program nights, because people just knew they had to get loaded to watch these two movies back to back.
So the thing that makes a Neil Breen movie so fun to drink to, last time I had one of these, I got a big poster board, wrote all the rules on it. And the movie runtime is about 80 minutes. I think it took us 3 hours to get through it. Not because, you know, we're not enjoying it or anything, but it's just the amount of times that you have to sit there and just chug drinks, or people have to, like, hey, I need to go to the bathroom, pause it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you're courteous. I wouldn't have paused for shit.
Oh, no. I'm not making them miss a minute of the suffering. That's what it is. There's no courtesy in that.
You're like, oh, shit. All 7 of you have to go to the bathroom at the same time. Either you hate this movie or there's like a fucking gangbang going on in the bathroom at this moment.
No, we're getting through it. Yeah, it took us 3 hours to get through the 80-minute film. my favorite, if you haven't seen his newest movie.
Oh, I haven't.
No. Or Twisted Pair, which is his other one's making like film festivals right now. It's winning awards for some ungodly reason. But Twisted Pair, he figured out like how to use a green screen. And it's, you mean, it's so
he thinks
awful.
He figured out how to use a green screen. This is what you're trying to say.
We refer to it as the Breen screen the whole time. But if you need a good night to entertain people, a Neil Breen movie and with some drinking rules, it's a great way to do it.
I love that.
So we both collect vinyl records, right?
Yeah.
And once again, let's say we're hanging out. What is the record from the collection? Let's say three records that you're going to go off and grab.
Okay, that's cool. Let's see. Definitely Pink Floyd, Dark Side of the Moon.
That's an excellent record.
That'd probably be number one. Then the Jeff Beck Group self-titled LP is number two. Practically no words, almost all instrumental. And then, let's see, I have to pick an obscure, wacky one, right?
Right.
Okay, I got this. I have this LP from the 1960s called The Baroque, as in Baroque music, B-A-R-O-Q-U-E. It's called The Baroque Inevitable. And what it is, it's classical Baroque renditions of 60s classics. So they've got like a Baroque rendition of Yellow Submarine on there, and like Rolling Stones shit, but it's all like harpsichord and like violins and shit.
Right.
Oh my God, if you get stoned to that, it's fucking crazy. Like that's like a perfect end of the night. Like what is this? I've burned that LP for so many people because it just doesn't exist anywhere. Found it at a yard sale or something when I was 17. It's called The Baroque Inevitable.
Very cool. You ready for your last question?
Yeah, man, let's do it.
Now, I consider myself a bit of a home cook, especially for me and my girlfriend. I'm the chef in the relationship.
Hmm?
What is, like, your go-to meal to fix? You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's a comfort food for you or just something that you really enjoy. I don't want to say, like, the fact that, it, like, you know, how long it takes, prep time, anything like that. But, like, what is your go-to meal to fix?
Ooh, that's a good question. Because remember, I am a chef. But that's a misconception of chefs, is like there's stuff that we like to prepare for people in restaurants.
Right. So,
and then there's stuff that we like to prepare for ourselves and our family.
Right. So for you, like, you know, let's say everybody's sitting down to dinner.
Right. Okay. So my favorite thing to prepare is a paella. So like, really? I like Basque food. I like Spanish food. I worked in a Basque Spanish restaurant and an Italian fresh restaurant. So I've got this big, beautiful stainless steel paella pan.
Right.
So I like doing that, and I like making like a real fresh Caesar salad to go with it, like from scratch, egg yolk, anchovies, Worcestershire, the works.
Yeah, yeah. The real Caesar salad, not, you know, with the sauce packet or whatever.
Right. The real shit. Where you tear the lettuce, you don't chop it. So I like to make those, and then I will do essentially, it's my version of a bruschetta. So instead of putting like a tomato tapenade or topping on it, I do olives. So I'll take these long strips of crostini, brush them with garlic butter, and then an olive tapenade on top with like a little bit of manchego cheese, and then broil those. And that's kind of like my perfect little trio.
Okay. I mean, actually, that really sounds excellent, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
That was one of the, because it's cold now, and I say it's cold for me, you live further north than I do.
Mm-hmm.
Like gumbo is like this time of year, that's my favorite thing to do. I let one roll the other day for like 7 hours, and I couldn't even find, because I like to do chicken and sausage.
Yeah.
I couldn't even find the chicken because it had fallen apart.
I like making gumbo and creole too, like shrimp creole and etouffee. I love making that shit as well. Yeah. I have my partner's dad makes amazing gumbo, and he uses chicken thighs because he boils chicken thighs so long that when he adds in the crab, you can't tell the chicken from the crab.
Yep.
And that's pretty fucking cool.
You have to use chicken thighs in a gumbo, though. That's You have to. You can't use the white meat. You got to use the chicken thighs.
Because it just liquefies. It's great.
It's excellent. Well, Antonio, I hate to tell you, we are out of questions. Now, here's the fun part of Between Two Pods. Do you have anything you'd like to ask me before we get out of here?
Yeah, for sure, man. The anime, like the episodes that we've been on together were all anime-based. Yes. And my question for you is, do you prefer watching anime over traditional cinema? Like, if you had your choice, would you pick an anime film over, let's say, the latest Spielberg film or the latest Ari Aster film? Like, what is your go-to when it comes to that?
I'd probably pick the latest anime film, but I'm also, like, so let's say, you know, to go back to the question I had, you know, you and I are going to sit down. So comedies are, like, one of my favorite things. I'd say, like, uh-huh. Hey, do you want to sit down and watch maybe Airplane? Or, like, Animal House?
I'd always say yeah.
Or Animal House, or it's a little raunchy for the time now, but Blazing Saddles.
Yeah.
That is a hysterical movie.
Yeah, I love Blazing Saddles. I saw Blazing Saddles way too young and probably quoted it in moments that I shouldn't have in second grade. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially that intro scene, right?
Well, I have a very good recollection of being young and not understanding what I was saying and going to a birthday party and screaming, "Where are all the white women at?" And my mom pulling my hand away saying, "You can't talk like that."
But yeah, I'd probably go see like an anime film over anything. Like, one of the last movies I went to see was the finale for a series. Sometimes they do movies, right? So you'll get a season or two and then they'll wrap it up with the movie.
Uh-huh.
And I went to the theater to see the end of it's a rom-com called The Quintessential Quintuplets.
Oh yeah, you talked about that on one of our anime episodes.
Yeah, and it was me and a couple in the theater, and that was the entire theater. And this is not like a little mom and pop. This is like the AMC in town.
Right.
And I sat like two rows behind them to make them feel awkward just because of the person that I am.
Fuck them.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, y'all are not going to have your moment thinking you got a private theater. I'm sitting this close to you. Which they were cool. It was funny at the end because the boyfriend in the relationship, or, you know, I'm assuming the title boyfriend, but turned around, looked at me, and goes, "Is that what you expected to happen?" And I was like, "Well, no, not really."
Yeah, well, I mean, I ask you that because, like, I got to say, your conversation and the film that you picked for that episode I had you on, like, you know, cult-worthy anime, sing a bit of harmony. I mean, I'm not an anime guy. I'd only ever seen, like, old stuff and then the Studio Ghibli films. So to have Josh Scar bring your name and then you sing a bit of harmony, I mean, I subscribed to Crunchyroll just to watch those, and I haven't canceled it. Like, I haven't watched a bunch of stuff, but I have the intent to. So, me never having been interested in anime because of that conversation, now I am. And I think that's really important to have people open your eyes to things that you just kind of brushed off as, you know, it's a subgenre I'm not really into. And it fascinates me now.
It's not a movie, but it's a series. And I just, at the time of recording, it'll be already out, but I did an episode where we wrapped up our discussion for Attack on Titan with, again, Talking Smack. Like, it's over. And if you want to know perfect, in my opinion, and I think a lot of other people's, perfect writing, that everything is important and, like, everything's a plot point, no time is wasted.
Right.
You just need to sit down and watch Attack on Titan.
All right. It's on my list. Thank you.
It's four seasons. It ends with I'm going to do bunny quotes here, movies.
Right.
It's 2-hour-long specials, but it's dubbed in English, and the English cast is fantastic. But it's perfect. Everything in it is important. My girlfriend, she's never watched, like, anime before, and that was the first thing I introduced her to. And I gave her, you know, my Crunchyroll login, and then I think it was, like, a week later, it's like, "Oh, have you watched it anymore?" She's like, "Yeah, I'm in season 3. And I'm like, "What? When?"
Nice.
So it's perfect. I think even Justin said that he's watched a bit of it. And I think
he's not a huge anime guy either. So yeah, I'm curious to ask him about that. So yeah.
And I know this is, like, one of those things, and maybe you can think of something in film that has it as well, where you get, like, the negative stereotypes of, you know, like, a lot of people, I think, you know, you think anime still, a lot of people think back to, like, middle school, high school, there was, like, the smelly kid who Naruto ran.
Yeah.
But I think now, like, I think the pandemic's what brought a lot of people into it. They were home and bored and were like, "Well, I'm going to give this a shot," and then ended up falling in love with it.
Dude, that's why people are into the cult and genre films on these Blu-rays. is they couldn't go out to theaters. They started watching Tubi. They got into these subgenres. They're like, oh, someone's selling a Blu-ray that's got all this new artwork for $40. Yeah, take my money, right? That's like, that's what happened.
Right. You know, they're bored and at home. It's like, oh, I wonder if this is actually any good. And then, you know, next thing you know, like 12 episodes or a couple hours have passed by and you're like, damn, that was good.
I think I had this conversation with a guy on an episode that's about to come out about how that kind of bred this weird subculture in this boutique labels where they just start blind buying everything because they just want it on their shelf. And then they actually watch it and they're like, oh, this is dog shit. And then I'll buy it from them on Mercari for like half off. Like,
right.
I don't need it now. I'll get it when you're sick of it. And then I'll buy it from you for half price when you're crying over your credit card bills. That's my move.
Yeah. And you're sitting there like, oh, I need to make that money back.
It's like, I got you.
Here comes Antonio like, take my money.
Cha-ching! Absolutely, man. Done.
Oh, was that okay? I didn't know if you had any other questions.
No, no, that's it.
Well, wait, let it. What? So you're are you a wine guy? Just out of.
I will do wine for podcasts because I want my wits about me.
Gotcha.
I made a mistake one time and I did a whole pitcher of martinis while I was a guest on another show, and I started talking about fucking JFK assassinations and. Like all sorts of crazy shit. And like, okay, well, this is a podcast about food. I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. So yeah, I want to keep my wits about me on shows now.
The episode that comes out, not next Monday, but like the end of the month, is with me and Decaying with the Boys.
Oh boy.
And they had recorded one of their episodes prior and they'd been like taste testing beers for their whole episode. And then they did this with me.
Yeah,
and it is a little bit of a drunken mess. Thankfully, it turned out good, but
I can't wait for that one.
Oh man, I showed up sober and they were already like feeling it. It was a great conversation overall, to be honest. It was a lot of fun. But if that is the end and you have no more questions for me, other than your assignment of go watch Attack on Titan.
Yep.
One more time, where can everybody find you on the internet? And please tell them about all of your shows.
Okay, so I'm the host of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast. That's the main one. Cult Worthy Classics still exists. I'm just not making new episodes. The MILF and Me. It's a romantic buddy comedy sex help but talking shit podcast with my friend Diana. And then my new show, Back to the Balcony with Justin Henson, where we talk about the critiques of Siskel and Ebert. All those you can find on all the platforms. They're all on YouTube. But go to thecultworthy.com. because that's the easiest place to find the shows, to find my blogs, to find any like Blu-ray reviews I've done, but also people like Slade, people like Josh Scar, my other mutuals. I've got a Cult Worthy Partners page that has links to all their shows. So pretty much anything Cult Worthy, go to thecultworthy.com.
All right, Antonio, thank you so much, man. This has been an absolute blast tonight.
A blast. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, this has been an absolute blast, and I hope everybody looks forward to the next episode. We'll see you then. Bye, everybody.
Goodbye.